Welcome to Local Talk, Monday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Paul Wearson.
And I'm Dennis Hart. Well, Paul, this is the first time this summer that we have hosted this broadcast on a Monday, and I have to say you are looking quite spiffy on this first day of the work week. You've got a red shirt on with blue jeans. You are spiffy, my man.
I look just like a mouseketeer or something like that.
Well, except for the hat.
Hey, Dennis, you know, last night was the championship round for the Bill Riley Talent Show.
At the fair.
I always watch that, yep. And, of course, I try to match wits with the judges, you know. And I'm very proud of myself. They pay the top three people with monetary prizes. And I picked one and two perfectly.
Wow.
So to me, that makes me an excellent judge of talent.
I'll tell you what. Not only were you an excellent judge of talent, you were witnessing the very last Bill Riley talent show hosted by a Riley, because Bill Riley Jr. retired after last night.
That's right. But you see, since I'm a great judge of talent, that gives me great pleasure to be here with you and Mike Murphy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'm really conferring talent on this whole room.
But I don't think I'm ready to sing this morning. Can you give me a few minutes?
Well, you can
warm
dance,
up the voice?
Yeah,
well, we have quite a program to kick off this week here. Coming up a bit later today, the City of Ames Forester is going to be here. Yes, the city has a forester. His name is Paul Tauke. And he's in charge of all the trees in the public domain here in this city. And he has been, oh, so busy, replacing the ones we lost to the derecho last year and getting rid of some that are threatened by that insidious little creature we've talked about before. So stick around. He will have a whole lot to say.
And so will Maggie Westfold. She'll join us with her Minutes with Maggie segment. And you won't want to miss that.
Indeed not. But first today, we are so pleased to welcome back to Local Talk the mayor of Marshalltown, Joel Greer. He's been with us in the past to talk about Marshalltown's recovery from that devastating tornado that hit the city 3 years ago, and he's joining us now to talk about that ongoing project and another one, the recovery from the derecho that struck the state just a year ago. Mayor, it is good to have you with us. It's been a little tough to get you on the air today, but we're happy you're here.
Well, sorry, I'm not here by Zoom. I don't know why I couldn't connect that way.
That's all right. We are very happy to have you with us here by any means possible, and in this case, of course, the telephone. Let's remind people about what happened on that July day in Marshalltown 3 years ago when the tornado ripped through your city. No one was injured, fortunately, but plenty of damage. Talk about that, please.
You bet. Yeah, there were actually two microcells that came through, one after the other, at least at our home where I was. And one of them ripped right down Main Street and caused a lot of damage at major businesses, took out the courthouse top and continued on to the northeast side of town, and then just wiped out the Lennox manufacturing place. So that one was pretty destructive, including the trees that you were just talking about with the derecho, but the derecho was worse on the trees.
Well, you know, my first thought when I heard about the tornado was checking out to see if Taylor's Made Right was still up, because that's my haunt when I go to Marshalltown, and that was the one breath of good news. Now, Mayor, how long did it take on that courthouse project? That took a long time to get that back up, wasn't it?
You've put it in the wrong tense, actually, because it's still going back up.
It's a work in progress.
Yeah, the last prediction was Christmas. I predict it's going to be February or March of 2022 to finally get it done.
Well, talk about the damage that the tornado did to that courthouse. It was extensive.
Yeah, the damage was extensive, mostly because everything worked in the water system. And so it was the water that caused the significant damage, not the wind. And then, oddly enough, even though the predominant force was going from west to east, and the main courtroom up on the fourth floor is on the west side, nothing happened to the courtroom. So it's a gorgeous courtroom. It sustained no damage at all. But the clerk's office and the recorder's office and all the county attorney's offices and the other smaller courtrooms sustained significant damage.
So you probably had to go down to the studs to work with the walls and all that sort of thing.
We did. Actually, what was interesting was the day after the tornado, the governor and lieutenant governor and one of the U.S. senators had come to Marshtown to see things. And all of us straight up to the top floor of the courthouse. Turns out we should not have been in there because of the type of damage that had existed and the structural issues that were in there. Nobody got hurt in that tour, but when the workmen got there and assessed the damage, we were told we were lucky nobody did get hurt when we were through there.
Of course, the dome came off the courthouse. The tornado tore that dome off. That's the image everybody remembers. And for those who haven't been back to Marshalltown, if we looked at the courthouse this morning, what would it look like from the outside?
Actually, the dome's back up, and I got in a little trouble because I was there watching that happen with my wife, whose office is going to be in the courthouse. She's on the Iowa Court of Appeals now, and most of those judges stay in their hometown county seats and in their courthouses. So that's where she'll be. This was right after COVID was kind of a hot topic. We were more than 6 feet apart, but one of the photos that was put in the paper made us look like we were closer to each other and close to the next person. And so on social media, I took a lot of flack for why would I encourage people to be there to watch the dome going back up on the courthouse. But the dome, the spire is back up. The statues are still in I'm accustomed to talking about statues. The statues are still in the yards, waiting to get back up there, but the spire is up, and then I noticed a week and a half ago they actually put the lights on behind where the clocks are. The clocks aren't working, so you can't tell time at the courthouse yet, but at least at night now there's a little bit of activity up at the top.
Well, a lot of progress has been made. Now, downtown, I know a lot of brick buildings were brought down, or at least partially. Were any of those significant historical buildings downtown?
Yeah, I would say the Fantles building is what most of us call it, the one that's right on the intersection of the southwest corner of Main Street and Center Street. That one has come down. The building next to it has been taken down, and we're pretty sure the next two buildings west of there, because of the adjoining walls, are also likely to be coming down too. It's taken years for the engineers and architects and other people to make those assessments and then actually do that work. I'm sure some of the other buildings that were damaged have some historical significance, but that's the one that was kind of the showpiece, centerpiece, and the toughest one, at least for me, to have seen come down. We'd actually considered buying that building and putting our law office in it before the tornado because it was a pretty structure. There are still some other large brick buildings on Main Street, block to the west of there, that have been deemed to be dangerous and dilapidated, and they're coming down ultimately too. We're experiencing a lot of delays in lawsuits and enforcement of the statutes that allow us to acquire the buildings and take them down, and it's pretty expensive to do. They're all old enough to have asbestos in them, so it's not an easy task to take them down. And I know the McGregor's building, which is the flagship of the McGregor's furniture stores throughout Iowa, it sustained significant damage. They fixed up twice now when they had damage from other buildings coming down. There's yet one more building to come down, and we're trying to figure out how can we not make them have to go through that whole process a third time.
Well, now, Joel, what's your feedback from private homeowners? We've had, 3 years now. I assume that most people have had their claims settled and are made whole to some degree by now.
Well, you're asking an interesting person about that, because our law office damage done by the tornado was finally finished about 3 months ago. Our home, the damage from it was more derecho than tornado. We still have a few final pieces to put together, but finally the main parts have been, the roof work has been done. huge tree that went through the sun porch roof, that has been repaired. And we've been lucky enough to have 10 trees planted in the back of the yard. Other people are still waiting for the materials and workmen. And there's still a lot of work to be done around town.
Joel, if I remember correctly, the northeast part of the city, the neighborhoods there, were heavily damaged by the tornado. I remember going through there, maybe a week after the tornado, and it was like a bomb had gone off in some of those neighborhoods. What do they look like today?
Pretty barren because of the lack of trees. And we're estimating that the derecho tripled the tree damage compared to what the tornado did. After the tornado, it was pretty barren. But the tree loss was really, really significant up there. In terms of the damage to homes, most of those have either been repaired or raised. Although there are still some, I know there's some on North 3rd Avenue, some on North 2nd Avenue that are under the process of reconstruction.
Well, I understand there have been some success stories downtown, Joel, of businesses recovering, and could you share some of that with us, some of the good things that have happened downtown?
Yeah, I sure can. Yeah, the success stories are those that were able to hang on, especially the restaurants that were able to make it through the trifecta. It wasn't just the darn tornado and the darn derecho. It was the COVID-19 that was a real challenge for some of the restaurants. Those that have been able to sustain, and actually we haven't lost any of the eating places. They're all there. We picked up Asian food last night at the Ocean City. The beauty of that building was that it had a 1960s facade put over this beautiful marble columned look of an old bank that it was. And so the tornado did us a favor to reveal what had been back in the early 1900s, and it has that look now. They were busy when I stopped in last night. That was great. And they used that time to fix up on the inside as well. The Tremont and Italian Grill sustained a lot of damage and used the time that they were closed to remodel, repaint, have new wall hangings, things like that. The bike shop is selling significantly more bikes now than they did pre-tornado. They were able to knock out a wall while they were closed and open up a new, very attractive space. So the McGregor's building is gorgeous. They redid their facade. They're back up and running. They're missing the top floor, but you'd never know it. That has not been a problem for them. So those are just some of the local success stories. And, yeah, you're right. Taylor's Made Right did not take a hit. It was difficult for them to be open for a while, but they were able to sustain by having the drive-through window operate, which they hadn't been using for years. But that was allowing customers to still pick up the Made Rights.
Yeah, if Taylor's had been destroyed, I'd still be wearing sackcloth. that would really be bad for me. That's one of my favorite places. Now, tell us about the class of 1969. They're going to do something for the town.
Boy, I'll say. They had originally had it. It was kind of fun because they were getting geared up for a reunion of some sort and decided that what they really should do is help on the tree replacement after the tornado. So they passed the hat. They started to raise some funds. They were aiming for something in the neighborhood of, I think, $50,000, which would have replaced quite a few trees. And the last I heard, they had raised more than $125,000. It was looking like it was going to be upwards of $150,000. And what they had raised would have been enough to replace every single tree lost in the tornado.
Wow.
With the derecho, that put the challenge back out there. And so they continued to step up the efforts to raise funds. They've already planted trees at the Veterans Home. They have enough trees to not only enough money raised, not only to replace the damaged trees, but also to add trees to different areas like the schools and the veterans' home. And they've just been phenomenal to watch what they've been able to do. You're talking about your arborist in Ames. Before I got on the air here, we certainly have one here. And the weird thing is that people think, well, let's plant them all right now and get going on it. But you can't do that and be prepared for what can happen in 20 or 30 years for the next bug or event that can happen. So we have to plant them gradually over the next 10 years, actually. And we have to be very careful what varieties we put in and how close to other varieties to have a mix.
It is 15 after the hour on this Monday, and you are tuned to Local Talk on this Monday on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Dennis Hart with Paul Wearson, and our guest is Mayor Joel Greer of the city of Marshalltown. We are reminiscing about some events that took place starting 3 years ago. A tremendous tornado ripped through Marshalltown and destroyed part of the city. Derecho last August. And Mayor, you've been telling us the difficulty of coming back. The town sustained severe damage. We know that we lost about 400 trees in the derecho last August. Do you know how many trees Marshalltown lost combining the tornado and the derecho? I mean, what are we talking about here in terms of numbers?
I don't. I should know that, and I don't. And it's not because I haven't been told by the Class of 69 representatives or by our local arborist. But if I had to throw a dart at the dartboard, I'd put it at around 1,200 to 1,500 trees, given the double whammy that we had.
Wow, that's a lot of trees. And you say that Northeast neighborhood was particularly hard hit.
It was, yeah. The rare trees that are left there look pretty damaged. They're pretty hurt. And so you can simply see blocks away that you could not see before. The packing plant is a large building, large white building. You couldn't see it from Main Street. You couldn't see it from other streets driving by that were two, three, four blocks away. And now you can pretty well see it from about any direction. That one will take 20 to 30 years to get the trees back up and get our canopies back.
Well, assuming you're my age, you think, I won't live to see the really fruits of this in terms of shade trees, you know, and the effect they have. And we don't know until we lose them how extremely valuable they are, not only for scenic attributes, but also an old tree takes a lot of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. A young tree, not so much. And they just have tremendous value in saving energy. It's just, I don't know how you can even measure the benefits a tree canopy has to a town. So we're all feeling bad about that, not only the tornado, but also the derecho. And Joel, as you said, COVID-19 makes it a trifecta, a hat trick. And that's a lot to happen to a lot of communities in Iowa, but particularly Marshalltown. And you know, it just seems to me when my weather radio goes off and there's a front going from west to east, the warnings are always for Jasper County and Marshalltown, Marshall County. And I thought, this is just sort of a track of weather that goes through all the time.
One of the things that was fortunate about this, though, if there is anything fortunate, and it was, I think, dicey, and you tell us, Mayor, is the packing plant, which employs so many people there. And, you know, the worry was, would this plant ever come back? Talk about that.
Well, actually, there were two major concerns, and both plants. There are 2,400 people that work at JBS. It actually didn't, the kill floor and the main processing plant part did not sustain as much damage. What was damaged there was the country's largest chilling station. And so the immediate problem we had at JBS was there were something like 120 semi-loads of frozen pork that had to be disposed of. We have a very successful, vibrant landfill here. It simply didn't have enough cells, didn't have enough space open. So we had to go to the Des Moines metro area. Somebody actually was able to find a company down in southern Iowa that was able to buy some of the frozen pork to use with pet meal, things like that. But that was a major concern, was would that stop operations and unemploy a bunch of people for a while. The bigger concern, frankly, was that the Lennox plant had about 850 employees, and it was leveled. How nobody was hurt there is still just an amazing miracle to all of us that saw the plant after the tornado went through. The biggest concern, the immediate biggest concern for this mayor and for our council was, what if they simply just decide not to rebuild in Marshalltown? The plant manager is in his last assignment for Lennox, opened a plant in Mexico, and it had not been fully operational yet. And so it would have been very easy just to say, well, this damage was too great. We're not going to rebuild in Marshalltown. Let's start making the furnaces and air conditioning units down in the Mexico plant or some other place. And there certainly were other cities in the United States that were aware of what happened here, that were courting the Lennox Corporation to build there instead. And so the biggest concern I had was, are you going to stay or not? And Lennox higher-ups, the president of the company, other very important people flew up here and had a meeting with me the Monday after a week ago. Let's see, it wasn't the Monday after the tornado. It was on the Thursday. It was the Monday after that, which was our next city council meeting. And they had a meeting with the governor at about 3:30 that day. They had a meeting with me at 4:30 that day to say, we are going to stay. And they timed that so that I could then go to the 5:30 p.m. city council meeting and make that announcement for them. And that was pretty exciting to know that they were going to stay as well. Now, looking backwards 3 years, 3 months ago, both those corporations are in full swing, full operation. The JBS has been expanding different lines. They have built a lot of things to make the place safer for the virus challenges that they've had. And Lennox is back up to the level that it had been with the number of employees. So we lucked out on both those major corporations in town here.
I am really happy to hear about the corporate loyalty. You know, they didn't have to do that, as you pointed out. And, of course, the biggest problem with both those employers is, well, the individual economic impact for those people who'd be out of work for an unpredictable amount of time. So that really turned out well for Marshalltown. And I think it speaks well of you and all the people who related to the Lennox people to make them want to remain in Marshalltown. So give yourself some credit, Joel. Okay.
Joel, we have maybe a couple of minutes left. I want you to say what you want to say, but what would you like us to know about Marshalltown's recovery? What would you like the public to know in the last 2 minutes here?
Sure. The fun thing about this job now, about 3.5 years later, is that we're doing ribbon cuttings. We're digging in the earth to put up a new hospital, and like Cedar Rapids experienced after its flood, like Parkersburg experienced after its tornado, at 10 years out, we will be bigger, better, stronger, more vibrant downtown on Main Street, on 13th Street, which is another shopping area. And we're already experiencing a real surge in living spaces. So the fun thing is we're going to have a new hospital. We're going to have a new medical clinic. We have five grocery stores that have either built completely new or remodeled and are looking very good. So the recovery phase has come along fine, and nobody was killed. Nobody was seriously hurt. We're coming through this in pretty strong fashion.
Well, you know, it occurs to me that since the statues aren't up yet on the courthouse, this is an opportunity for the Joel Greer statue to be erected. I'm voting yes for it.
Mayor, we cannot thank you enough. We can't thank you enough for being with us this morning and talking about the recovery of your town. It's been too long since we've had you on, and we wish you nothing but the very best in terms of Marshalltown. Great town, great downtown, great neighborhoods. Good luck to you and everybody there.
See you again at Taylor's.
Very good. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you for joining us, Marshalltown Mayor Joel Greer, good man. Now, don't you, listeners, even think about touching that dial, because after this brief timeout, the man in charge of trees here in the city of Ames is going to be right here. And trust me, we have plenty to talk about with him as well.
Well, we're back with more of Local Talk Monday on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Paul Wearson.
And I'm still Dennis Hart. It is 26 minutes after the hour on this Monday, and our next guest is the forester for the city of Ames. His name is Paul Tauke, and he's in the midst of replacing all those trees we lost to the derecho last year, as well as taking out lots of trees threatened by a particular bug, and we're going to talk about all of that. Paul, welcome to Local Talk.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
First of all, for those who don't know about the city of Ames having a forester, what is it you do in your job?
Yes, basically my job is to take care of all the trees in the city right away. So it would be that area between the sidewalk and the curb in most of town. And then if you happen to be in a part of town that doesn't have any sidewalk, typically about 15 feet from the curb. Could be a little less or a little more. You know, one thing that's consistent in Ames is there's inconsistencies all throughout town when it comes to where the city right-of-way may be. But as a general rule, it's sidewalk to curb. Also, I'm responsible for the trees that are in the mowed part of the city parks. And then the city of Ames also has about 800 acres of wooded area that we are trying to get a handle on and manage that, primarily to keep out invasive species that are a real problem, not only in our city woodlands, but all over the state of Iowa and throughout the Midwest. And then I also do the burning program for the city's, 100, 115 acres of prairie that we have. Most of which is at Ada Hayden, but there's little pockets of prairie scattered around town. So that's in a nutshell. It's kind of what we do on a day-to-day basis.
Well, Paul, this is another Paul, Paul Wearson, on the show with Dennis here. I understand that you had a personal encounter with the derecho. What happened in your case?
Oh, yeah, we were just a typical day, prior to the derecho, and my supervisor had contacted me and asked if we had a crew out, and we did have a crew out pruning park trees at North River Valley, doing a little lifting, looking for hangers, things of that nature. And so I ran down and got them in the shed, got them back to the shop, and the storm rolled in, the derecho rolled in. And my office is in the cemetery, so I was in the cemetery office with the cemetery caretaker, and we were kind of watching it roll in and watching the branches fall out of trees and roll across the cemetery, kind of like leaves in the fall. And suddenly he goes, oh, branches fell out of that sycamore tree and hit your truck, my personal truck. So I looked outside and I said, well, gosh, I hope the damage isn't too bad. And he goes, yeah, I think it's going to be pretty bad. So when the storm went through, went out and took a look and had $6,500 of damage to my truck. It damaged the hood, broke the windshield, you know, dented the front quarter panel, dented a door, etc. So, it didn't take me long to have kind of a personal stake in the derecho. And of course, then we got out to try and clear the streets and clear electric lines and followed up with trying to get hangers out of trees that were hanging over the street and the sidewalks. So it was a pretty busy time for several months following the derecho on a personal front and a work front.
So tell us how much damage Ames sustained that day. What did the city look like and how many trees actually were damaged or destroyed?
Yeah, from a tree perspective, you know, it looked, you know, kind of like a war zone out there. You sort of had trees all over blocking the streets. There was trees, both right-of-way trees and private property trees that had fallen into people's driveways. Over on Kellogg, there was a tree that fell and crushed a guy's pickup. There were several cars that were damaged, you know, as a result of the storm. We lost about 300 trees total in the immediate aftermath in the parks and in the city right-of-ways. And then probably in the follow-up, you know, as we got out and inspected, we found trees that were damaged in such a way that they were structurally unsound. You know, we had a huge hackberry on 10th Street that was cracked right down the middle, almost to the ground. It didn't fall, but it was no longer structurally safe. And if it would have split in the next heavy winds, it would have either taken out additional power lines or probably crushed a house. So we had about, I'd say, 50 or 60 trees that came out after the initial run on the derecho that were just no longer safe. And we found trees like that for months, really, as we were doing some of our routine zone pruning and maintenance. When we got back on that, we'd find trees that had damage that I'm fairly certain was sustained in the derecho, and they were really no longer safe. And then we had probably about 650 to 700 hanging, broken branches over streets and sidewalks. So there was a total tree damage, and then there was damage of such a nature that it just wasn't safe until we could get those hangers out of those trees. And that was a rare instance where typically we don't do work on trees on private property. That's homeowner's responsibility, but following the derecho, if there were trees that had hangers that were over the street or sidewalk, we did prune those or get those hangers if we could reach them with our equipment or had our contractor do it, primarily because we knew homeowners couldn't get a tree service in the aftermath of the derecho, and we just wanted to make the city as safe as quickly as possible. And then we also did work in people's backyards as we were assisting electric when we could with cutting trees off of power lines, which is nothing that I really would care to do again. Even though the lines aren't hot, when you have a big tree on a power line, there's cables there. And we had a couple instances, I'd call them close calls, where as you cut the weight of that tree off of that power line, it's like a rubber band in a piece of paper. You reach a point where enough weight gets off of that cable that the cable springs back, and you're not sure where that tree is going to go when it springs like that. So it was an interesting time, and one that I hope we don't repeat anytime soon.
Well, now, what kind of crew did you have, numbers of people, to do this gargantuan task?
typically, our summer crew is myself, and at that time two seasonals. Now this year I have a full-time maintenance guy assigned to me, So our typical summer crew is pretty small. But when this happened, it was all hands on deck. So we have three guys that work under kind of the turf part of Parks and Rec, and five that work under the structures part, so that we had those eight. So they, you know, everyone that we had was on trees. And then we had some assistance, really, like some of the water guys from water came over. You know, they were asking where they could do to help. Of course, Public Works was out clearing streets, and Public Works was integral in the cleanup as homeowners brought stuff out from their yards and set it on the right of way. A Public Works with some assistance from the Iowa DOT, actually, they went from the south side of town to the north picking up debris, and they made two rounds of that. So it was, you know, our crew was relatively small, but we had lots of assistance from within Parks and Rec and then from within the city as well.
That's great that everybody saddled up and handled this problem. Now, I remember that. Now, of course, the power was out a long time for a lot of folks, but I remember all the debris at the curbside from private home trees and also from your parking area. I just wondered, where did all that material go, Paul? Where did it end up?
Okay, so what happened was we have a site for city, you know, for stuff that city that is from jobs from the city on 13th Street. We have a place where we take our logs there. They actually opened up a place to dump it there, and then also over by the power plant, the old coal yard. So it showed up there, and then Iowa Department of Iowa Homeland Security contacted the city, and they paid not just, I think, in Ames, but Des Moines and other cities that were hard hit. They contracted with somebody to come and chip that material. So all those huge piles of trees and damaged limbs were mulched, and Homeland Security paid for that. And my understanding is that the chips from Ames went to the landfill in Boone. Now, understand that they didn't go there into the landfill as landfill material. They went in, apparently there was a part of that landfill that was going to be capped off. And so as part of that capping process, they utilized wood chips to cover the debris, is my understanding. So they were utilized there to help cap off the part of the landfill in Boone County that wasn't going to be used anymore.
So everything has a use. I like that. Now, what about replacing the trees now? This is the big project. What's happening on that?
We have been continuing our normal tree planting program, which in the fall we replant one for one every ash tree that was removed. We replace that with another tree. So that's sort of our routine fall planting. Then in the spring and fall, we have another volunteer event that we do with the Ames Foundation. So with those events, we're probably planting around 100 to 110 trees a year. So what we were looking for was additional funding to plant more trees to get the numbers back up. So last fall, we got a grant for an additional $5,000 of tree planting from Alliant Energy and Trees Forever. So we did that last fall after the derecho. So that allowed us to add about 25 additional trees. And then we applied for another grant. So this spring we had $10,000 additional funding from Trees Forever and Alliant Energy. And then the local City of Ames chapter of Trees Forever donated $1,000. And then the Renewable Energy Group, REG, here in town, they donated $3,000 for replacing trees in city parks. So we've been finding funding to help continue to plant. We've just received another grant for $4,500. That we're using to plant additional trees this coming fall. REG, after the initial planting this last spring, they have committed to another $15,000 over the next 3 years. So they're going to provide $3,000 each spring and fall for the next 3 years for additional tree planting. And we have applied for a grant with the DNR for some additional tree planting. And I believe that's right around $4,600. So we're using the normal allotment of funding that we get for city tree planting. And we're using that as match for any grant opportunities that we can find to continue to plant. And we're getting close. If we happen to get this DNR grant, we'll know that September 1st or 2nd. You know, in the last 18 months, we've gotten about close to $30,000 of additional grant money for tree planting.
Paul, we have only about 4 minutes left to talk about two major issues, and so I'm going to ask you to be concise. We know that the emerald ash borer is devastating ash trees around town, and they're being taken out by the hundreds. And you also told me when we got together about a month ago that another insect is threatening, perhaps, maple trees, and this is a long-term threat. Can you talk briefly about both of those?
Yeah, basically, with the emerald ash borer, the city started with about 2,200 trees, and then in 2014, the city council passed what's called the EAB response plan. So we have been removing trees each year. I've been here since 2018, but since 2014, the city has been removing trees, and we've reached the point, we're in year 8 of the plan, and we're down to about 430 ash trees remaining, and this year we're removing 38 ash trees, and next year we're going to average probably about 40 to 50 a year for the next 12 years that we would be removing. So that's kind of where we're at on that, and that's just city trees. We really don't know how many ash trees are on private property, but we know that it is really devastating those in many parts of town. So that's going to be a problem, certainly for our homeowners and for us if they happen to fall into the street. And then the other insect, which is not in Iowa, but it is in Ohio, is called Asian longhorn beetle, and its preferred host species is maple, although it does have a little bit wider palate. It will also affect birch trees. So that can devastate maple in the same way that EAB can devastate ash. Now, the upside of Asian longhorn beetle is it's a bigger insect. It leaves a bigger hole in the tree. It's a dime-sized hole. It's easier to detect. And it has been successfully eradicated in Chicago and on Long Island. But in Ohio, it went undetected for quite a long time, and they're having trouble containing it there. And it's also one of the issues is the cure is about as bad as the disease if you get Asian longhorn beetle, because the remedy, at least currently, is if you found Asian longhorn beetle, let's say, in the cemetery in Ames, every maple tree, potential host tree within a mile radius would have to be removed, whether it's on private property, public property. So the eradication has to be done or it will spread. So if you don't eradicate it, you're going to lose those trees eventually. But if you're in the eradication zone, you're going to lose those trees regardless. So I'm hoping that they contain it in Ohio and it never gets here. But it is a reminder to people, if you're traveling, do not move firewood from state to state, because that's how these pests move long distances.
It's always
firewood, especially in Ohio. Burn it there. Don't bring it back to Iowa.
Yeah, Paul, that's good advice. And you know, it just seems that when these pests come, they're so devastating, and it's always terminal for the trees. And we know that it takes so much time to recover, to get that tree to be a big spreading, shading tree. And I really endorse all the things you're doing, and I know you're the decider about what species to buy.
Yes, and we're trying to diversify our tree population as much as possible. And currently in our city right-of-ways, we have 30% maple, and ideally we'd like to have no more than 20%. So we're really planting a wider variety of species, and we're discouraging maple. At this point, we're not actively planting any in the right-of-way. If we have a homeowner who maybe lost a maple for some reason and really wants another one, we might make an exception. But by and large, we're really trying to promote other species until we have greater diversity in our urban tree canopy.
Paul, we will have you back to talk more about this, and we really appreciate your being on the air with us today. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You betcha. That's Paul Tauke. He's Ames City Forester. Coming up next, one of our very favorite people with one of our very favorite features. We will be right back.
Back with Local Talk on this Monday. I'm Paul Wearson.
And that was Dave Brubeck. Boy, it's nice to have Dave on our show. And I'm Dennis Hart. I'm happy to be on the show. And Paul, our program here would not be complete. It never is complete without Maggie Westbold. We call her appearance Minutes with Maggie, and we are delighted to have her back with us again today. Hello, Maggie. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
Hi, Maggie. Happy fall.
yeah, Maggie. It's getting to be fall. Still a little going to be warm this week.
It's going to be hot this week.
But it is so good to have you back. As always, we have no idea what you're about to tell us, so why don't you start telling us?
Now, Paul, you've told me before that you follow me on Facebook, so you may be familiar with this topic I'm going to cover today. After you asked me, Dennis, if I could think up something to talk about today, I had a little experience that I think deserves airtime. I was looking for a little Norelco recording tape that I'd lost track of, and I found that. But in searching for that, I found something that was so much more meaningful. In the corner of my bedroom, I have a vintage oak music cabinet that stands there. It has a top drawer that holds special things to me in many ways. I guess you'd call it a meaningful collectible storage drawer. And that day I pulled that drawer out and I set it on the bed beside me to sort. And one item at a time, I started my search for my little recorded tape, which, by the way, I found right away. But as often happens when you're into a box of mementos, everything in the drawer just kept drawing me in and I kept sorting. There were three covered jewelry containers, and when I opened the last one of the three, I found a mound of angel pins, like you'd wear on a blouse or a lapel. And now I'd gotten away from wearing pins much in the years since I left DOT in the regular workday, so these lovelies that I'd worn for years, they had just been lying around feeling all ignored. And at the bottom of that little dish, there it was, Mom's pretty rock that she had found as a child along a creek bed in southern Missouri. That mesmerizing piece of agate in swirling browns and tans was set in a gorgeous gold filigree heart-shaped brooch. It was even more lovely than I'd remembered for all the years that I had considered it long gone. I just sat and stared at it. I was looking at what my angel pins were hiding from me. My husband had had a coworker back in the late 60s whose hobby was tumbling rocks and finishing them out as jewelry, so Steve asked Mom if she'd like for him to have his friend make a brooch out of that pretty rock she always talked about. And to give credit where due, the guy who did this was Bob Siebel from Story City.
Oh, I know Bob.
Yeah, he's long deceased, but he did a masterful job of polishing that stone and setting it in a beautiful filigree heart-shaped brooch.
Wow.
Mom loved that. She loved that pin, and she told me she wanted me to have it when she was gone, so I was very sad when after her death in 2005, the pin was nowhere to be found amongst her jewelry that was in her nightstand at her room at the nursing home in Story City. My sister Barbie clearly remembered bringing the brooch to Mom from Mom's home in Colo, so we knew it had been there. And I assumed that someone felt they needed a pretty pen and helped themselves, and that had been my assumption for all these years. So one of the first things to hit me when I saw that laying in the bottom of my jewelry dish was, you know what, guilt. Because I was elated to see that pen all this time, that I thought was gone all this time, but I had suggested many times over the years that someone with sticky fingers had lifted that lovely thing. We didn't know of anything else of value of Mom's that had disappeared, and the folks who cared for Mom at Bethany were just wonderful with her for 3 years. So to squelch my guilt a little bit, I took a photo of the found brooch, and I posted it on my Facebook page with an open apology to any and all readers. That was the only way I could think of at this point to apologize. I had obviously had brought the brooch home prior to Mom's death, likely at Mom's prompting. The way she enjoyed wearing her lovely jewelry most days, I would have left it with her as long as she was enjoying it. Seeing that Facebook post, my nephew Joe out in Virginia made me even happier when he said, "I love rocks," and he identified the stone for me. In the world of rock hounds, that stone is called Crazy Lace Agate. And are you ready for this? It's also called a happy stone. Oh. How about that one?
I love it.
My happy find that day beneath my angel pins in the bottom of a long ignored jewelry dish made me so happy I truly would have done a happy dance, folks, if I wasn't presently dealing with a gimpy hip. My Facebook post did say, "Color me apologetic and happy." And then my nephew tells me that rock hounds call it a happy stone. Hmm. What I call this, my friends, is one happy ending.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Maggie, that's wonderful. You know, my career was in Des Moines, but I moved up in retirement to live on the farm I grew up on. So I'm in the house with Mom's spoon collection, her cup and saucer collection, her cream and sugar collection, spoon collection, thimble collection. And a friend of mine brought his little boy out to sell popcorn for Boy Scouts. And I took him through the house and showed him all. And my stuff is up there, too. When he got back in the truck, he said, "Dad, Paul lives in a museum." And I guess that's true. All
Maggie,
the things we value.
you might call your discovery serendipity, but maybe this was meant to be at just this moment in your life. What do you think?
Yeah, I kind of think so. I kind of think Mom was talking to me. I'm not sure what she was saying, and I think a lot about that, Dennis. I don't know. What do you think?
You know, things have happened in my life where it could have been just coincidence, but there aren't a lot of coincidences in life, as detectives will tell you in the police department. Maybe it was meant to be. I thought that at points in my life. I'm sure you have, Maggie, and I'm sure you have, Paul.
Yeah, it's sort of a awareness, sort of a current, you know. Mm. And this is a whole new way to be stoned, I guess.
Maggie, very quickly here, you remember, of course, all these years, Bill Riley Sr. and Bill Riley Jr., and Bill Riley Jr. retired from the fair, the show, yesterday. How far back do you go with the Rileys, watching them?
What was that last question?
How far back do you go watching the Rileys?
Oh, my goodness. All my life. I mean, I grew up here. So whenever they started telecasting the fair, I did not ever get to go to the fair as a child, but whenever they started putting that on television, I would have been watching.
Oh, yeah, and I worked with Bill Riley, both Bill and Bill Jr. I emceed the show in Story City, and so I teamed with Bill Jr., but I knew Bill Sr. too, and he was one of the folks who were in radio who did make the successful transition to television, and he was a short guy, but a big guy, and he's from Iowa Falls, and the band shell up there is called the Bill Riley Band.
Sure it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Bill Riley's one of those guys who, from the earliest days of television, was one of the real pioneers, Jack Shelley, Russ Van Dyke, Paul Rhodes, certainly Mary Lou Varnum, and Bill Riley Sr. And it's a loss for the fair. It's the first time next year will be the first time in 60 years or so that the fair will not have a Riley hosting the Riley Talent Show.
Oh, it's part of our lexicon, and it leaves a real hole, but I think he's still going to host the highlight show on PBS. So that's
I hope so. Maggie, it is, as always, a pleasure having you here, and I enjoyed hearing from you on Facebook Messenger this morning. You sent the message at 2 o'clock in the morning that you would be here, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm happy to say I went back to sleep after that, but I was glad to find you on there.
Well, you reassured me.
Maggie, we're so happy to have you. Don't leave us. We're going to be doing this for a long time, I hope.
I just remembered something about Bill Riley Sr. You got a minute for me to tell you?
We got about 30 seconds.
30 seconds, right.
Okay, somehow when he was on TV when I was a kid, I sent my name in for a drawing, and he pulled my name out of a bag and sent me a whole box of Payday candy bars. He was my hero, don't you know? And my mom let me hide those and divvy them out as I wanted to.
Oh, that's great. A great story. Maggie, we're back on September 8th. Will you join us?
I'd be glad to. I'd be happy to be with you.
It's a deal. Okay. Maggie Westfold. We got to go, Paul. You have been listening to Local Talk Monday. I am Dennis Hart.
And I'm Paul Wearson. If you missed part of our program today, you can hear a recording of it online or hear a live stream of all our shows on KHOI at KHOIFM.org.
Thank you so much, Joel Greer, Paul Tauke, and Maggie Westphal for being here, and thank you so much, Mike Murphy, for engineering this broadcast. Our theme song, you're about to hear it as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
And stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 and Morning Masterpiece at 9. And remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening and tuning in today, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Indeed.